Hi, I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
Hey, I'm Nicole Eunice. I am a ministry leader in Richmond, Virginia, as well as an author, and excited about a new book coming out in a few weeks called Brave Enough. That's all about everyday courage and confidence that we can find in Christ for our everyday life.
And I'm pretty sure that you're the first person I've interviewed that actually also does podcasting. And the last time I checked was like in the 400s or something. Is that accurate? Have you done 400 and something podcasts?
I don't know if it's 400. I think it might be in the 200s.
Okay.
But in the hundreds, for sure. Not to mention being on other people's podcasts. So lots of podcasting.
Yeah. And then do you wind up sort of batching it in one day and doing a bunch of episodes? Or how do you?
Yeah, we do. So I podcast with my senior pastor. We started this a little while ago. We have a little joke around Richmond that everything's 15 minutes away. So it's a small city. And so we thought, well, what could we talk about that's a 15-minute drive or a 15-minute walk to reach our community and help them engage with everyday matters of faith between Sundays. So we started that a while ago, and we'll do maybe four or five at a time. Mm-hmm. So once a month, maybe. And we just love it. We just pick up a conversation that we've been having and have it online. And we found that people, especially people who travel, find it's a way for them to feel engaged and in a conversation, even when they're away from home.
Absolutely. And it's really practical stuff. And I think it's nice to have, I was thinking about how much I love the medium because it's really content rich. It's not a lot of fluff. You can just cut straight to the meat and people want to hear that too.
Right.
So, and then when I'm getting your feed a little bit in Facebook, and I noticed that you guys finished a capital campaign. And you can clarify a little about your church too, because when you use the word campus, when a church uses the word campus, I usually think we're talking mega church, right? And I don't know how big your church is, but tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it's been a really great part of my life. This place that God's put me, Hope Church started about 18 years ago, and that's the same year that my husband and I graduated from college, got married, and moved to Richmond. So we were not really in, really didn't know what we thought about faith, or kind of were interested, but hadn't really embraced what that would look like on an everyday basis. And we found this church someone invited us to. There's maybe 70 people in a elementary school cafetorium, and we fell in love. We just love the place and love the people. And so we've been in a relationship with this church since the very beginning. And now Hope, now I'm on staff, and Hope has grown to be a very large church in those 18 years. And so we're just embracing who God's called us to be and how we can reach people. And that means lots of building and starting a second site in September and just trying to just ride the wave that he's put us on. So it's really an exciting time.
Yeah. And it looks like there's, so much that you do. I know the one thing was the Youth Lodge. It looks like, is that like a retreat thing or is it like a gym or?
Yeah. So we have, we're right on the edge of the city. And so you're still really in the stream of suburban life, but right on the edge. So if you went west of where we're placed, it becomes like kind of country and rural. And when we bought that land in 2001, we knew that a major highway artery was going to be built right there, and there was planned development in that area. The development has been a little slower than we expected, but it still became this major artery. But what the beautiful thing that's happened is it's become a very close-in place that people feel very peaceful, and it's kind of up on a hill, and we have about 35 acres. So even though it's right in the stream of people's lives, when you drive up that hill, you kind of feel like you've stepped away from your everyday life. So we want to capitalize on that. So this lodge is a place that's primarily for students. It's not a retreat place. It's an actual like building that we'll use all the time, but it has a retreat-like feel because of the way the land is. We have wetlands on our property. People all the time, I think, with church want, I think we have this tension where we want to be utilitarian and say, like, let's use the least amount of money possible for a building and just try to get the most impact. When in reality, you know, we're people with a mind, body, and spirit, and we react to the places that we're in. And I remember once we had a funeral on our site in our building. Our building was only built in 2008. So we were a church for 10 years in high schools. So we know what it means to not have a place, and we know what it means to have a place. So we're hosting a funeral, and I can see across the concourse two people that clearly had never been in the building before. I don't know what they think about God or Jesus or anything, but people come to a funeral no matter what because they want to honor that family. So I'm standing away from this family, but I can see that the woman, I can see her mouth move, and that she says to the man, "What is this place?" Like, it's just a disarming place. It's a beautiful place. And we put a lot of money into making a place that's aesthetically pleasing, and you walk in and you feel like it's a place that you can be settled. And that's a choice that we've made as a church. You know, I think it's great when churches are very utilitarian with their buildings and their properties, and just kind of like, this is just a box, and, you know, it's just a place for our people to gather. But we've done something a little bit different, and we've really tried to embrace the property God's given us, this beautiful place, the wetlands, the hills. And we're trying to build buildings that go with that feel and allow people to feel removed from their life. So we get excited about all the ways that we can use a building, a collaborative workspace where people who are, you know, independently working can come during the day and work, you know, all the different ways, retreats, a second worship site, a place where kids can do their homework, a place where they feel like they don't need to be necessarily as connected to technology because they just enjoy this beautiful place and kind of in nature.
Yeah. And it is really important, I think, to engage all the senses like that and get people to connect with beauty. I was just talking to someone in a previous episode, and we were talking about sometimes we've put, as Christians, put truth before beauty. And, and now the culture especially is very receptive to receiving beauty, which is just as much truth, but it's kind of coming at it through the senses and the imagination. And there's the whole hospitality piece there too. If people feel welcomed by the aesthetics or by their surroundings, then their heart is more open to the whole community.
Absolutely. I think I heard author Ian Crone say artists come through the side door of the soul and preachers come through the front door. And it's true. And there's a way that you can disarm and come through the side door of people's souls when they're engaged in different ways other than just intellectually. And, you know, it's also interesting when you think about church history. The church has always been a place, you know, in the whole history of the church, a place of beauty and a place of wonder and a place that's a forerunner of art. I mean, I think we've lost that a little bit. And I think there's a movement to try to recapture that space. Like, this God who is an amazing creator, who is the inventor of beauty and is so wildly diverse in his expressions in nature of what beautiful is, like, why wouldn't we give a lot to that concept, you know? So in our own little way, in our own little place here in Richmond, we're trying to do that. We renovated an office space for our new building, and we took many of the elements from our property and brought them to this office building that's kind of in more in the Midtown area, so much more in the city. But we brought, you know, walnut and these wood tables and the colors and the feel, because we thought, you know, we want, even in the middle of this like strip mall, we want you to open the store and feel like you've entered in to a new space that you can, maybe let your guard down, maybe feel like you've removed yourself from the world for a moment. So that's kind of our heart behind what we're doing and why we're, you know, putting a lot of money behind those kind of things.
Yeah. And I appreciate that too, being coming from a creative side and an artistic side, that has gotten lost sometimes more so in Protestant traditions, but bringing it back seems good for the soul, like feeds the soul. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So I first was introduced to you through your other book called She's Got Issues, and you very successfully did a lot of, I mean, I was drawn into the promotional aspect that you did for that book, and it seemed like it went really well. And then as you get ready to launch this new book, what caused you to write it, and maybe for people who haven't been introduced to it yet, you could kind of summarize what you're up to with it.
Absolutely, yeah. So I wrote She's Got Issues because of my own, I was teaching a lot to women and really have this passion for people to connect their inner world, their thoughts, their everyday life to the relevancy and reality that God is really speaking into our hearts through His Word and through people and through nature. And we can have this really vibrant, rich daily relationship with Him. But it, you know, it takes some work to get there. We have to kind of commit to it. And sometimes that comes in sort of more desperate places in our life where we realize that the way we've been living or trying to make it work just isn't working for us. And so She's Got Issues was a little bit about that. Those kind of six. So I came out of counseling first before I was in full-time ministry. So after spending about 8 years in private practice, I started to realize, you know, you can really boil down most every issue from middle school to middle age to like six big issues that I found myself helping women with, just ordinary kind of everyday stuff, not dramatic, not traumatic necessarily, but definitely a hindrance, something that's keeping women from being their full free selves. So She's Got Issues came from that. I had no idea how that book would go. It was my first book. I'd never written before. I didn't have a big audience necessarily, just had, you know, a publisher that believed in me and wanted to see it go and just tried to do my very best with what I had. Mm-hmm. And I was so happy with how God used that and has continued to use it for women. And, you know, I don't even know if you would consider this a compliment. As a writer and a teacher, you want people to love your words or to feel like you have great insight. But the number one thing that when I speak and write that people end up saying to me is, you're so honest, which is good. Kind of funny. You're like, okay, because you sort of like, here, say something nice about my words or some insight that I gave you. But it's just, you're so honest, which is sort of in a strange way. It encourages me to keep writing, but at the same time, it makes me think, what is it that we've been doing in Christianity that makes honesty such a revolution? Like, why is it that you're so honest is this revolutionary concept for women?
Oh, that's
so
good. Yeah.
I have just really leaned into that. Like, if women want to tell me you're so honest, I need to do everything I can to be as honest as I can with myself, with the stories I share, with the reality of our inner world, and keep doing that because it's setting women free, really. Like, I can really say how I feel. I can really listen to what my heart and my mind are saying. I can trust that God can work in that, and I can be honest with my friendships and in my Bible study and in my book club. So that's kind of, that really fueled a fire for me. And so with writing, of course, you kind of think about a lot of different things you can do. And I had a lot of different topics and ideas, but a lot of those things are usually good for about 5 pages. And then you don't really have anything else to say. But this idea of Brave Enough came out of, I was actually watching a movie with my daughter, and it was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I don't remember this part in the book, although I've gone back to research and know that this part is in there, but it was very, it captured my heart when I saw it on film. So the kids have come into Narnia. Narnia's frozen. It's a war. A battle is about to start to kind of take back Narnia. And Father Christmas comes to them to give them their unique weapons, the things that they're uniquely equipped to fight. And he hands Lucy, the littlest one, her weapons. And then he says something like, something along the lines of, it's never pretty when women go to war, or something like that. And then he says to Lucy, he looks at her and says, do you think that you can be brave? And she says, in a very innocent sort of 7-year-old way, I think I can be brave enough. And that just totally caught my attention. And I thought, what does it look like to be brave enough? I don't know any women who consider themselves brave, although I consider many women brave. Very few women will self-identify as brave. Like, they think the word's too big for them, their life hasn't required that kind of courage, when in reality, I think all of our lives require a great deal of courage to just be brave enough for what is in front of us that day. So the book really came from thinking, what's a follow-up to She's Got Issues? Now we've dealt with all these hindrances. What does it look like to walk forward in freedom? Like, how do we now proactively take who Jesus Christ can make us to be and live that out on an everyday basis? So Brave Enough is really about grace and the effects of grace. Like when you start to really experience God's grace for yourself, what it does to your insides, mm-hmm. and then as a consequence, what that looks like on the outside, how that looks in our relationships, in the way we fight with people, in the way we live out our calling, mm-hmm. in the boundaries that we embrace, all these like practical everyday ways that grace works itself out in us when we are brave enough to just try to start living that way each day.
Mm. And it seems like your focus mainly in ministry and your audience is mainly women, but do you find that men have, has that resonated with anything?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, in my book, yeah, I don't really write books for women. It's right? just that women buy books. Mm-hmm. And when you, are in publishing and you don't have like a distinct audience, it's harder to sell. Mm-hmm. And so as a younger author, I'm very much developing like a reader base, and that's great. I love women. I love speaking to women because I think that hearing from women is like hearing in your first language. It's like mm-hmm. our heart's first language is woman. And mm-hmm. so when you get to hear teaching from a woman, I think it can really sink in deeply to women. But in reality, I spend almost all of my working life working with men. I mm-hmm. preach at my church, so I'm teaching men all the time. I work and lead young leaders. Most of them are men. All of the people on my team are men. So mm-hmm. I just am sort of not letting myself enter into lots of definitions about mm-hmm. who I am and what I'm supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I just believe in the Bible. I believe in the way God's word speaks. And whoever wants to read that is fantastic and great with me. But I do think I do have this little part of me that believes that women don't get to hear necessarily as much in their first language, because very few women mm-hmm. are hearing women teach or preach. Mm-hmm. So they're translating everything they hear from their preacher or their pastor or whatever into their own language. So that analogy or that context that maybe is a little more man-oriented, we have to then work in our own hearts to translate that for ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I love the gift of being able to speak to women in their first language, but yeah. I'm also really excited that God's given me the opportunity to work on and teach men and women.
Yeah, that's a great distinction, because I think in publishing, a lot of times you'll get pigeonholed, or it's part of the promotional process of, yeah. okay, here's sort of, you know, zoning in on this target area. But it was like, it's like Brené Brown, and it's similar topic in a way too, and she talks about vulnerability and courage, and I it's safe to say she speaks to men too. Obviously it's not it's the same kind of ministry situation, but I think it's still just as important. Like, she realized that she had been speaking to women first, and then a man approached her and said, it's really convenient that you're speaking to women, because, you know, he was basically kind of saying she wasn't being brave because she mm-hmm. wasn't speaking to both of them, and that men actually had more vulnerability issues because women wanted them to be, you know, bulletproof. And it was really convicting for her. And then she switched everything she was doing. And it's really interesting, even though it might translate a little differently. You know, we're humans first, I think. Right. And then we have these core insecurities and vulnerabilities that need to be addressed no matter how we're experiencing life gender-wise.
Absolutely. I think I'm just processing. I'm like, in 272 pages of Brave Enough, I can think of two paragraphs that are about women specifically. Mm-hmm. One is a study on how women express anger. And the second is a slight little time where I talk about how women's calling is complicated by often many different seasons of life. And men's mm-hmm. lives generally are slightly more linear than that. And I think that's it. In the whole mm-hmm. book, there's two paragraphs about women's specific issues.
Right. That's interesting. I know one thing that stuck out to me, and something it was actually a video I was listening to, and it was talking about this this prevalence of upspeak, where you end your words like higher at the end, yeah. like mm-hmm. this, right? You know, whatever. And it's right, and it's actually like a weak form of speech, because it sounds like you have a question. You know, it's one
right,
of these things,
right?
And so what was really fascinating is that women tended to say that with their name, and men tended to speak in that fashion with their profession. And I thought, oh, that's not interesting. So, so me, I would, you know, I'd be, I'm Lisa DeLay. Like, well, am I, you know, you know, who am I? And then men would say, something, you know, I'm a mechanic as if like, do you understand what I'm saying to you? Like, and I thought that was really fascinating, but that, that type of, you know, who am I in the world? And, you know, I don't know, I'm sure it's different for every person, but, you know, whether you're insecure about your role or yourself as a person or your, what you're doing, is it important enough or significant enough? It's, we all have these little trappings sometimes, but it's interesting to be sort of called out on it. Like, oh, do I do that? Am I saying my name with a question? So,
interesting. Really interesting.
So what are some of the main, if you could break down your Brave Enough book a little bit more into like a couple nuggets, what do you think are some of the most important takeaways from your book? Obviously, you have to leave some for us to find out in the book itself, but...
Well, it was interesting, as a book process always is, you're kind of like, where's this all going? You know, it's like a... It's like a recipe that's coming together and you don't even quite, you're not quite sure what you're making, but you're just kind of going on intuition. What is this going to be? And what I discovered by the end of the project was it really was, it does follow kind of a narrative arc of the heart, which is this internal place of what happens to me inside of me as I deal with the everyday challenges of life and my own failures and limitations. And then the book moves to how does that express itself outwardly in the proactive steps that I'm taking to really be full and free and move confidently through life. And I didn't really know that when I started. I sort of thought I had a lot of different ideas and I didn't know how they would come together, but I'm so grateful for the way they did, especially with great editors, because to me that is the arc of the heart. If you think that you can be really successful in the way that you live your life, not the way the world measures success, but just successful in the sense that I know who I am and I know how to serve in this world because of who I am. If you try to do that without really knowing these deeper places of entering in to grace with Jesus in your heart, you'll just hit a glass ceiling where you can't get further and you don't know why things are hard or why you can't seem to move forward with freedom. Because there's this work to be done on the inside. And I think one of my favorite parts of, about the book is this concept of fake grace. Just the ways that we make excuses and concessions and blame all inside when we have a hard thing. Like if we're having a conflict with someone, what actually happens in that conflict? What excuses do we make? What do we say to ourselves? Well, I'm busy, I'm tired, this person expects too much out of me. What ways do we blame others? In a way that really doesn't invite a spiritual relationship at all into those everyday places. So that's probably one of my favorite parts of the book, is really trying to help people connect to the ways and beliefs that they have inside of themselves that tend to make them make independent choices and independent thoughts outside of really inviting Jesus into that place and stopping those thoughts and thinking, what am I doing right now? Like I'm making all these excuses. I'm making a litany of complaints in my head because of this hard thing that happened at work today. And I'm not even really asking for Jesus's grace to be with me, to forgive me, to help me understand my limitations and who I am and what maybe he's doing in someone else. But we just sort of do this thing in our head. Like we just get, you know, quote unquote, give ourselves grace, which is a ridiculous concept. Like we can't give ourselves grace. That's the whole point. so that's probably one of my favorite things to try to bring to people, to women, to men's attention, is this has been in the Bible since the beginning. We all tend to arc back to law, to rules, to works. We all do that because it's so frequently mentioned in the Bible that it's definitely a part of human nature. And being able to see how you do that and move away from that and really like embrace an everyday, every moment kind of place where you're like, oh, like I was just really frustrated in this moment at work. And this doesn't feel like a place that Jesus should be invited into. But what grace really means is that I can like take a bathroom break or walk outside for a second and just ask God to reset my heart and to help me see myself for who I really am, who he is, and enter back in with this kind of spiritual reality in my workplace, in my family, in these difficult relationships, whatever that thing may be.
And it's kind of that what you're talking about, that radical honesty, I think, is kind of what you're hitting, is that we being honest with ourselves? Are we even aware, first of all, but like, are then we being honest with ourselves is, okay, this is a little bit of an ugly thing I just found about myself. Mm-hmm. And is God's grace sufficient for that or not?
Right. And how do I even just make space? I like the idea of imagining, you know, whenever you go onto an elevator and the door starts to close before you're in it, and you have to sort of violently push the door open to get it to go back, you know? You can't kind of half do that. You have to really push hard to make the door stay and make the elevator stay. And I sometimes think there's like this place in our soul that's like that elevator, and we start to enter in and we want those doors to close really rapidly. Like, we don't like to stay there, and we sort of have to force that open and say, no, like, this thing that I'm thinking or feeling that actually is kind of ugly and not... wow, I can't believe that I have such a condemning thought about another person, or wow, I can't believe I have so much sort of self-hate about this part of who I am. Those doors want to close really fast. And this invitation to grace is to just kind of really intentionally crack those doors open and be like, no, like, this is a place I need Jesus Christ's presence and healing. That's all I can do, is open myself up to his presence and healing in this place that I really want to shut the doors fast.
Oh, yeah. And it does seem that people serve, and I think God uses people to serve as a mirror for our own internal stuff, that the stuff that bothers us about other people is, they're sort of mirroring what we are despising, maybe even under the surface in ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, that, oh, this person's so judgmental, then we're judging them as we're, you know, judging them as we're saying that.
Right.
And I'm wondering too, if this circles back to, obviously these are human problems, and it doesn't all have to do with past trauma or a lot of emotional baggage, but I'm sure it also, and from your counseling background, I'm sure that our baggage and our issues have something to do with that part too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, everyone can go back to She's Got Issues when they realize that they have issues. But yes, of course, like, all of those things are those places. And so the book, after talking about kind of this idea of you can't give yourself the grace that you need, there's quite a bit on forgiveness. One of the things that's so interesting to me that, again, maybe God just really illuminated as I was studying for this book, is we kind of know this, and we hear, maybe if you're around church, you hear the Great Commission, go and make disciples of all nations, as what God, you know, as what Jesus really has tapped us to do as his followers. But the interesting thing to me is at the end of the gospel, when Jesus first appears to his disciples in his resurrected form, the very first thing that he does is he breathes on them, which, of course, you have to be very close. To have someone breathe on you means that they are in your space, like, as personal as you can get. I mean, when's the last time someone breathed on you? Like, you don't really want people to breathe on you, you know? You know, it's just, that's like a very intimate expression. Like, I'm going to breathe on you. And then that Jesus Christ breathed on them and gave them the mission of forgiveness. Like, people will know you're my disciples by the way you love and forgive. And that was actually the very first commission, was if you forgive others, they will be forgiven. And it's kind of this reality check that our number one mission in life, as a way of expressing God's glory and Christ's transformative work in our heart, is the way that we forgive. And that really does get into a lot of our issues, you know, because we do oftentimes live out of a lot of hurts. We live out of a wounded place because of something far in the past, or even the enemy is really good at this. We can develop a sort of thought about ourselves, like, let's say a common one with women is, I'm too needy. We can develop that, and we start to categorize experiences that we've had in order to support that hypothesis. So we've got a hypothesis about ourselves. Circumstances come that I often think there's spiritual realities to those circumstances, that there is an enemy who is working to help us feel unworthy and to feel insecure and to keep us paralyzed. So we can be sure that the spotlight will fall on circumstances that support those hypotheses in our heart. And we sort of may have other positive experiences that don't prove that we're too needy, but we forget about those. And the ones that really support that we are too needy, we remember those really well. and we start to really believe it. And there's this place of going all the way back and not judging ourselves, but just being like, who am I really? Do I believe that to be true? Is that a true thing? And how does God help me forgive the people who've been part of me believing that, and trust and lean into his understanding of who I am rather than my understanding of who I am?
Yeah, and it is true. We develop a lens from which we see life, and then get evidence to, because we're trying to categorize life and make sense of it, right? Then,
yes, absolutely.
Then doing it in this destructive, potentially destructive way. I remember having to, not even realizing I had really negative self-talk. I was in college at the time, and I was beating myself up over something, and it was like this long verbal parade of unworthiness and boy, are you stupid, and how can you not figure this out, and then I was like, I think I've been having a two-hour conversation, you know, beating the stink out of myself, and I'm not sure that's going to help.
Yeah.
Yes. Kind of realizing I had this problem in these tapes playing in my head that I was co-opting with.
And yes, absolutely.
It's so destructive. And then trying to figure out, you know, then not swinging back to the other way to self-aggrandizement, right? Mm-hmm. But being able to say, you know, God sees me and loves me, and he knows the stuff that's not good and not working out and hurting me, but he also knows my potential, who I really am, and all the goodness too. And then can I start to see myself through his eyes? And is that have a personal significance to you at all, or
like, yeah,
what, what's,
I mean,
part
I
of your journey?
Yeah, it's funny you said all those things. I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, I wrote about all those things. I wrote about all the internal, you know, and I try again with that spirit of honesty. I think sometimes we can talk in generalities about those things. So I try to talk in real specifics about them in an honest way, like, okay, here's the situation and here's what I was saying to myself in the situation. Mm-hmm. So who can I blame, or how do I blame myself, and what are those ways that develops? And she's got issues. Spent a lot of time talking about why we are the way we are. There was a chapter in each. So if the issue was comparison, there was a chapter on why we are the way we are, what makes us want to compare, then moving on to how can God work in that and move us to a different place. In Brave Enough, I focus more on, okay, regardless of the reasons why we are the way we are, how do you really move to the next place? Like, so a little bit less about your past, a little bit less about that. Those things are important, and those are accessible in the other book. But really saying, okay, women, if you've embraced that, if you really want to live in an everyday adventure with Jesus, what does that look like when you are thinking this thing on your way home from work, or when you are feeling so low about the way that you've treated your children, whatever that thing is, like, how do you actually get deep into God's word to understand what he says? And I just want to say that what I was saying about Jesus breathing on you, for anyone who's listening who wants to find that for themselves, it's in John 20, John 20, 19 through 23, where he talks about being breathed on and being sent out to forgive as the number one thing we do. And I think in God's gracious way, he gives us opportunities for forgiveness every single day. So we all kind of have an everyday mission that starts in these small ways that oftentimes feel harder than the big things, like, let's start a nonprofit. Not that that's not a great, but, you know, first and foremost, we're called to forgiveness and love in the relationships that God's already placed us in.
Absolutely. And then part of that forgiveness is also like forgiving ourselves for our shortcomings. And
absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. And it's kind of, you can't have one without the other. Like, I'm really, you know, I'm really gracious with other people, but I'm not with myself. I don't know that actually that is even possible.
I think you're right, Lisa. I think we might pay lip service to that, but really loving people in their limitations, really loving them, I don't think is possible without really loving ourselves and our limitations. I mean, and God's the one in his word that really puts those things together, you know? He says those that have forgiven little love little. I mean, that's just the reality of, I think, the economy of our heart and the way it works is that without a great understanding of our own failure and limitation and God's great love for us in it, it is impossible to understand other people's great failures and limitations and really love them in it.
That's beautiful. That's great. I probably will wrap it up here and let you get on with your day, but that is just an awesome nugget, and I'm really glad we could spend a little time, and maybe we can touch back as the journey progresses for you. And I'd love to check in at a later date and maybe do another power pack session.
Absolutely, Lisa. It's been so enjoyable to spend the morning together, for sure. And where can we find this podcast so I can send it to my people too?
Sure. It's available on iTunes and Stitcher, and it's just the website with the show notes, which I will eventually send you links to this episode, and there'll be show notes back to your site and your book and things. It's sparkmymuse.com.
Awesome. So I'll get that, put this one up, and then let my listeners be able to check back in with your other, guests that you've been having on. And
that'd be great.
What's something that you've learned? What's one of your favorite things about the process?
The process relating to
podcasting,
podcasting. I actually just really enjoy conversations and seeing where they go. I think not holding the reins tight and just allowing people to, I don't have any notes. I kind of do a little research on the person ahead of time, but I don't come in with any notes at all. And then I'm just very curious about people, and I kind of feel like every opportunity is a learning opportunity. Mm. And it's extra. It's like 10 times 10 when I do an interview with someone, because I usually it's fun because I get to talk to anybody I want, and I just ask, and if they say no, I haven't lost anything.
Right.
If they say yes, that means I get to talk to someone I think is really interesting, and then I'm not sure exactly who my audience is, but they must be a little bit like me to care enough to watch, to listen to 40 or 60 minutes of something. But it is a wonderful medium that I'm loving most more each time, because it's intimate and it's, straight into somebody's brain, basically. And I know that it's been very influential for me to be in the car. And apparently cars are going to be equipped standard with the ability to receive Wi-Fi and podcasts.
Awesome.
Like next year, I guess. And so a lot of people will be able to tune in this very rich way compared to listening to the morning show on some local radio station.
Exactly.
So I'm just really grateful, and thank you so much for spending a little time with me. And I'm really looking forward to the book, because it sounds so juicy, and especially the forgiveness bit, because I when I think I get that, then I realize I don't.
I think we're in a training for heaven on every day we're on this earth. I think we continue to experience new and deeper places that God's calling us to be brave in the way that we love and live. And that's, I think, just part of what's so amazing about a journey with God, is that we're never done, and we're continually being shaped and grown. And as a person now who's on the side of middle age, one of the greatest hopes and love about the greatest hopes about Christianity is that you're never there. You continue to get to be changed and grow. And sometimes that comes in some painful ways, but what hope we have that God never gives up on us and continues to change us and grow us and use us throughout our entire lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Every day is a new chance to learn grace in a fuller and richer way.
Absolutely.
And I'm really, really grateful for your wisdom, and you're bringing, if honesty is this radical thing and you're bringing it to people, so be it. it's a great recipe for becoming more like Jesus making our lives more radically like his. And so anyway, I thank you for that, and
absolutely,
being brave enough in your own life and just bringing that message out to people who need it so much.
Thanks, Lisa. One more thing I just thought of is that Brave Enough is an audiobook. So for your listeners who like audio and are maybe listening in the car or whatever, you can pick it up on Amazon or any major bookseller as also an audio. So, and I do, I narrate the whole thing. So that was such a fun thing, was to be able to read it myself and teach it live in that way. So, yeah. All right. Thanks, Lisa. It's really, really been good to be together.
I really hope you enjoyed the show today. Please come by sparkmymuse.com for related show notes and links and all kinds of other information. Don't forget to subscribe and please give us 5 stars on iTunes.